She's like, something's wrong. And I said, what do you mean? She's like, something isn't right here. And we just, it was just smoke in the forest. We were walking in the jungle and we came around the corner and there was blood on these stones.
Welcome to the podcast, Whiskey and a Map. Stories of adventure and expeditions as told by those who lived them. I'm your host, Michael Reinhardt. As an adventure photographer, I travel to the world's wild places to learn about the people, cultures, and wildlife that inhabit them and bring back their stories. It has been said that many adventures and expeditions started simply with a map and a glass of whiskey, a desire to go and see the world's wild places. You're invited to pull up a chair, pour yourself a glass of your favorite whiskey, and join us as we hear stories from another one of our friends just returned from the field. Luke Smithwick is a ski mountaineer and guide with 96 Himalayan expeditions completed in the past 13 years. Leading these expeditions throughout these vast mountain ranges, Luke has become a student of his people and their culture. Luke, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing?
Thanks, Mike. Thanks for having me on. I'm well. How are you? Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Ski mountaineering. What is that?
Ski mountaineering is climbing up to the summit of a peak or to the top of a route and then skiing it. So a lot of mountaineers, in the Himalaya, they come over and you climb from camp to camp and then finally to the summit if the weather's right, and then you hike back down. But as opposed to hiking back down, we ski back down. So it's I've always been of the motto that if you can ski it, then why not ski instead of walking? So it's more efficient. It's great for moving between camps when you're acclimatizing and climbing up peaks. And then it's great for your final, your summit day and your descent back down. So
this has to be pretty difficult terrain to come down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's really the challenge of it. I think, in some parts of the world, it's really big, just your form when you're skiing and moving on groomed terrain where a snowcat, a groomer grooms each morning and it makes nice corduroy that you make turns on. And you're focused on your form and, arcing turns with carving skis. Whereas we're really trying to ski in technical terrain where there's, we're moving in rocky couloirs or getting through rock bands and finding the way through. Or sometimes it's just a thin veneer of snow on ice. So it's definitely not for everyone, but it's something to me that I really enjoy, just the challenge of trying to ski terrain that was sometimes historically climbing routes that we're now skiing these days. So
was there ever a time when you had a really close call, a time where it was touch and go as to whether or not you were going to make it out and make it back?
In 2013, we had a storm that deposited about 2 meters of snow in 2 days. And that storm, it really sounded like a war zone when all the avalanches started to release, when the storm completed and we had sun come out and we had the day warming and all those variables that are all those factors that create avalanches, warming and sun on a slope. So when that started to happen, it was avalanching everywhere. And we did have some very close calls with avalanches there. So that one definitely stands out to me in the Himalaya for close calls. Yeah.
And where was that?
Oh, it's in the Garhwal Himalaya. The Garhwal is where Meru is. People have heard of Meru and Shivaling. And Changabang is also a pretty iconic peak there. And so we are climbing Bhagirathi 2 in the Garhwal, just above the source of the Ganges River, Gangotri. And that's when that storm hit in May of 2013.
And were we up on the mountain at the time?
We were, yeah. We were at Camp 2. We saw the storm had started. It was not stopping. So we started to descend down to base camp. It just continued to storm S10. S10 in forecaster language means 10 centimeters, more than 10 centimeters an hour, which is a lot. 10 centimeters is just under half a foot. So we were spending about every hour we were getting out to shovel out the tents, and we lost one tent because it was just snowing too hard. And we just, it was survival. You know, we had a stove going to keep water going for people while we were working to keep these tents from collapsing, because that was our way of staying warm. And that was we were on the mountain for sure. Mm-hmm.
And these avalanches, did they come close to you?
You know, at first, no, we could hear them. And it's really hard to tell when you're just in this fog, you know, basically inside a ping pong ball. It's just storming and it's white out. And we could hear them, and we weren't sure how close they were, just because sound travels very well when there's moisture around. So we didn't know how close they were. And then after it stopped, we were running out of rations. We were running out of fuel because we'd been in the storm, and we had a lower camp where we had some more food and fuel cached. So we knew we needed to move down to it. So I waited an extra day just because all the avalanches were running. We started to walk down the valley, breaking trail, and I should have had skis at the time. I didn't. In a meter and a half of snow, is, you know, it was coming up to my above my waist, walking down the valley. And then we just heard a big crack above us, and we did have a large avalanche come down to within a couple hundred yards of us. So that was pretty close, and we were only lucky. It just didn't run that far. But it definitely was large enough to bury and kill people. So,
yeah. In fact, it's a rather famous or rather infamous storm. Didn't quite a few people die during that episode?
Yeah, it didn't really make international news, but that storm in May of 2013, they say killed around 5,000 people, went missing, mostly because May is the start of Yatra season. So Yatris, which are pilgrims. So Yatris are in the area to visit Gangotri, the source of the Ganges River, Yamnotri, and a couple other sites of the Char Dham, the four holy sites. They're up there in May as that season started, and the storm hit and landslides happened everywhere. The road was essentially gone when we got back down the valley. We had to be helicoptered out by the army. There was thousands of us there queuing, waiting in line to fly out because there was no more road. They had to fly us out to the plains of India because the roads were gone in the Himalaya. So that was a memorable time for sure.
Pretty close call.
It was. Absolutely.
Yeah. How do you keep your cool when all that's happening?
I don't think you really have a choice. You know, it's you either keep going and you focus on, you know, life needs, or that's it, you know. And as if you're leading, then you're in charge of everyone else, and you have to keep things moving and things going and just keep moving forward. So, yeah, it's just focusing on survival. Yeah.
Now, Luke, my understanding is you have a background in studying cultures. Mm-hmm. You spent a lot of time in the Himalaya. Can you share with us some stories about the people and their culture that you've encountered?
Yeah. So I'll start with the nomads of the Changtang Plateau. The Changtang stretches from northern India into western Tibet, into western China. They're called the Changpa. So Chang means north, and then Pa means people. So the Changpa are people of the north, and they move around with the grass throughout the calendar year. They usually have anywhere from 100 to 1,000 head of sheep and goat, Ralug. And the Ralug, the sheep and goat, usually graze together. And they move with the seasons. And so it's fascinating to visit with them and see how they thrive and live their lives. The reason why they do it is the goats of their flocks are Pashum. So the underbelly fur of the goats is pashm, which is what pashmina is made out of. So like a pashmina shawl that you see sold in Paris or London or New York comes from these nomads. So they provide the raw material. It's sold to weavers in the Kashmir region who come over in the fall, in the autumn, and they bring it back home and they weave it into the shawls and rugs and things that are seen all over the world in fashion houses. So they're pretty interesting people to visit with. That's the Changpa. And then also you have the Raute in Western Nepal. And they're really considered the last hunter-gatherer group of the region. And so they still hunt monkey and they move around for hunting and gathering throughout the season. I've never been able to establish contact with them. I think it would be extraordinary, but it's never been able to happen. So the Raute, the Changpa, let's see, more popularly are the Sherpa. So Sher means east and Pa means people. So it's people of the east. The Sherpa originate from northeastern Tibet. They've migrated off the Tibetan plateau down into the river valleys of Nepal over the past 1500 years in various diasporas and various migrations over time for new grazing land. They generally inhabit the higher reaches of the Himalaya. I think part of that is where, you know, it's because they keep yak. Yak is a big part of their culture. And also because of being some of the final inhabitants to move in. So you have the Rai and the Tamang and other cultures that are down closer to the rivers. I think because of they were the first to inhabit the valley, and then also because of they live a different lifestyle than the Sherpa. So those are a few cultures that I have friends who are from those cultures who I've come to know through the years. I've just always been impressed by people's ability to, by the time they're 18, they can build a house from the land, just from things around them. And they're really in the more remote areas are still living in a subsistence lifestyle where they live off the land. You know, maybe they purchase sugar or they purchase tea, things that they can't grow at high altitudes. But I've always just really loved to learn how they make things and how they, you know, these tool technologies they pass on and how the elders are trying to maintain that. And that's rapidly changing in the past decade. A lot of the youth have gone away to school in Delhi. They've gone to school in Kathmandu or even overseas. And so it's a real battle, I think, for some of the elders to try to maintain some of those lifeways as, you know, as concrete moves in and different styles of construction, to see some of those ways of life lost. And I think that's just progress. That's just the way things go anywhere. But I'm always trying to document and write down what I experienced that I consider very important to maintain traditions. I'm very interested in things I think that most of the planet simply doesn't have time to or doesn't really care about. If you look at just a corner of Nepal, you have these very high mountains that are up to 28,000 feet separating two valleys. And if those two valleys are separated, you have completely different cultures developing in a very small area. So to go 1,000 miles across the Himalaya is a very long way. So it's fascinating to see how those words and how these ways of construction or how even like a tool, how it got from one area to another. So I'm always on an expedition. You know, I think a lot of climbers are just like, let's get to base camp, you know, whatever. For me, every day I'm like talking to shepherds or I'm talking to the blacksmith for the region. I'm just curious to learn how they learned what they learned and where it came from and why. And I ask a lot of questions, and I think people sometimes are they're like, why are you asking me all this? But I just find it fascinating. So, yeah, I write down all kinds of random things that I experience that I find interesting, that don't really have a thread of, a thread of thought always. Yeah. So
no, it's fascinating. And for most people, just to get a glimpse into that culture is, is rewarding. If you could tell us the story of meeting that shepherd and how it came about that you were privileged enough, lucky enough, I guess, to see a snow leopard.
It was really, we came up to, what's the name of the village? Nirak. Nirak is, it's like 2 days in on the Zanskar Gorge. The Zanskar is a large glacial river in northern India that originates in the Great Himalaya Range and flows down into the Indus. So I guess it'd be like a second order stream. And so we were in that valley and we were just stopping in Nirak like we normally do. It's kind of a stop off point for going into different areas of that part of the range. And someone just mentioned that had been once seen up the gorge the day before. And so the next morning we got up early and started walking and just managed to see it like clambering up a cliffside. And the leopard in that gorge, just like anywhere, they feed on blue sheep. They feed on marmot. They feed on ibex. And there was an ibex kill in the area. So we just got lucky. So it's kind of
how that. How'd it feel standing there and looking across and finally being able to see that
snow it's leopard? Unreal. It really is. There's such an amazing creature to like be this large cat thriving in the high Himalaya is, it's wild to see. So, it was pretty special and I wish the cat would have hung out longer. We didn't get to see it for very long. So yeah, it was neat.
In your travels through that area, I imagine you've come across and witnessed, different cultural festivals and rituals. Do any come to mind that you can tell us about?
Yeah. You know, I think what really stands out is there's still sacrifice in the Himalaya in some places. There's also traditional dances annually. There's also festivals. And so I have happened upon some of those throughout the years and also just scheduled and planned to go to some just because they're so regionally famous. Some of the larger monastery festivals for Buddhism in northern India, I've gone to see the mask dance, the Cham ceremonies. Then also happened upon other rites that were taking place for in Hinduism and in Islam and in animism and in those faiths.
I got to ask.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Cruising down the street.
My name is Noah, and I travel the back roads of America with my dog, Noodles, uncovering fascinating locations, history, and stories overlooked by the public. Explore the ruins where the first Salem witchcraft accusations were made. Visit a vast collection of masterwork clocks carved by farmers who rejected Henry Ford. Stand at the shores of the lake claimed by the ill-fated Donner Party. Travel back roads, pick up some history, and discover new locations. Hope to see you soon. Be good to each other. Where to next? Backroad Odyssey.
The ritual of sacrifices. Tell us about
that. I think that one was for the one that stands out in my mind. We were in far west Nepal. And far west Nepal is quite different than, say, like the Everest region. The Everest region now is quite developed for trekking and for tourism now. There's lodges, very nice lodges you can stay in, and there's apple pie you can get in German bakeries in the Everest region. And it's lovely. It's really nice to go there and experience. In far west Nepal, there's not really tourism infrastructure. It's people living their lives. And so we were sleeping in cornfields. We were chopping down old corn chaff stalks to make a place to sleep and staying behind schools. And that was why we went there, because we wanted to get away from like a more tourist experience. And so we were out there and we were approaching Api Nampa, which is Api is a 7,000 meter peak out there. And so we were on approach to there, and we were, we came up to the, to a Sangam. Sangam in Sanskrit is a junction of two river valleys. And so we came up to one of those. It's also called a Sundo in Tibetan, or in any of the Tibetan dialects. And so we came up to that area, which is a, it's auspicious in Hinduism, in Buddhism, in both those faiths. So we were coming up to that, and we smelled smoke, and we saw smoke coming through the forest. And my friend who was with me started to get really upset. And I was like, what's going on? She's like, something's wrong. And I said, what do you mean? She's like, something isn't right here. And we just, it was just smoke in the forest. We were walking in the jungle near this junction of two rivers. And we came around the corner, and there was blood on these stones. And locals were there, and they were sacrificing a sheep. And I'm pretty sure it was for Durga, Durga Puja. So Durga is a particularly wrathful Hindu goddess. And so they do that for to appease her. And so that's kind of what was going on there. And so, yeah, that was kind of that, that's what happened with that experience. So, yeah.
Well, what do you make of your friend who had that strange feeling as you're walking through the forest? What was that all about?
I don't know. I'm not sure why she felt that way. I thought it was quite odd. I still question her about it to this day. I don't know why she did that. Yeah, I really don't. Well,
what
did
she say?
She just said it didn't feel right. Something felt strange. And I guess she at that particular time had some sort of premonition. I don't really know. I don't know. I'm not a superstitious person. I don't really know. Yeah.
Interesting. So, you talked about observing the Cham or mask festivals. We've had a number of guests who have described mask festivals all over the world. Mm-hmm. The ones that you attended, can you tell us about those, what you saw?
Absolutely. Yeah. So Cham is, yeah, annually Buddhist monasteries, they bring all the masks out of their Lakong. The Lakong is the prayer hall in the center of the Buddhist monastery. And so they, each mask represents a particular character or god or bodhisattva. It can really, each mask can represent all sorts of things given the monastery and the particular sect of Buddhism. So they don these masks, they put them on, and then they come out and they do this dance around the courtyard. It's usually in a bit of a, or it can be in a bit of a circular motion, clockwise motion. And they practice this dance for months, you know, in the winter when I'm going in to go ice climbing or go, you know, walk up a frozen river, you'll go to the monastery and you'll see them out in their very thick woolen robes, just practicing this rhythmic circular dance around the square. And they have pieces of tape down that tells them where they put their feet and how they move as they practice that storytelling dance, which may tell about the history of the monastery. It may tell about a precept or concept of Buddhism. Or it may just tell a entertaining comedy story. You know, if you have a Cham dance that lasts an entire day, then you're going to have some comedy, you're going to have some storytelling, you're going to have all kinds of things going on within a given mask dance ceremony.
What is the strangest thing that you've ever witnessed out there?
Strangest thing. Okay.
The way I usually define it is something that, you know, you scratched your head and you asked yourself, did I really see that or experience that? Something you just can't explain.
For me, it's like trying to figure out what animals are doing. So like, for example, the Tibetan blackneck crane, which spends its summer. It's one of the few species of avifauna that migrate across the Himalaya. So they spend their summers up on the lakes of the Tibetan plateau, the Tibetan blackneck crane, and they nest there in pairs. And then they come together on a single day in the fall, and they fly all together in the thousands across the Himalaya. So it's always been a mystery to me how all these flocks come together on the exact same day. You know, they don't have phones. They don't have, there's no like radio call. How do they all know all these nesting pairs across the Tibetan plateau on all these different lakes, how to come together in a single lake, in a single valley, all rise up and fly together across the range? It's kind of a mystery to me that I haven't really figured out. So I think that's pretty strange. Like, how do they figure it out?
One thing I've got to ask, and this probably relates to a guest we had a season or two ago, and that is the legend or stories of the abominable snowman, the Yeti. Mm-hmm. Did you ever come across those stories?
Absolutely. Yeah. Everywhere you go, you know, local priest uses the Yeti in some areas, like in Makalu. You'll see a lot of lithographs, just like prints of the Yeti on people's doors. They believe it protects. It's a protector. And yeah, the Yeti has a different name in every language. You know, you have like Dremo in Balti, or the it just kind of goes along. That it's like Dremo or Chimo, depending on the dialect of Tibetan that's speaking about it. But everyone has a story about the Yeti. And I think that it's probably, it all came from bear, from the Himalayan brown bear, which I've only seen once. That was in Zanskar as well. But, you know, the Himalayan brown bear, when it crosses rivers, it tends to stand on its hind legs. When it stands up to sniff the wind, and I kind of think that's where the whole story came from, is just the brown bear standing up, you know, and people seeing that and the story kind of going from there.
What do you think the hardest lesson you've learned out there is?
No matter how well you plan something and execute it, it's not always going to be successful. Yeah, that's really hard. You know, just because you're putting all the right energy and preparation and execution into a project doesn't mean it's going to succeed. So that's a hard one to learn, that, you know, but I think that's important. You know, if we always are succeeding, then if there's no like uncertainty, then I think that's what mountaineering is. If you remove all the variables, all the uncertainty, then what's the point? I just don't see it. So I think that that's important. But yeah, that's been hard for me to learn, that sometimes it's not always on. And that's really also a big part of that. It's what we're focused on. I'm more focused on unclimbed peaks and places that, you know, on first ski descents. And so when we're going out to these mountains, there's no prior record. We just have a photograph, some, you know, grainy photograph. Google Earth really isn't that great for these areas because there's no economy there. So there's no reason for Google to really have much detail in these valleys. You know, so I have an image from Google and it looks like a scree field, but it's actually a talus field, you know, with giant boulders. So we can't make base camp there. We can't. There's a lot to, a lot to figure out. And so, when you're trying to make first descents and first ski descents, there's a good chance you may fail. That's been the toughest lesson to learn for sure.
As a leader of these expeditions, what do you find is the trait that makes a successful leader versus one who is not?
I think setting expectations, like right from the get-go. You know, it's like the day that people arrive, or if we're talking at home, I set expectations right away that we're not sure we're going to succeed at this. And so just what I was saying to you, I say to others, because we don't really know. And I think for some people that would be maddening to be like, no way, I'm not going. And I need, you know, it's like, yeah, in some ways, but for some people that adventure and that the unknown is very appealing. It's definitely not for everyone.
And why do you think there's people like you, like the folks that go with you that venture in these areas that are a little traveled by at least Westerners to mm-hmm. go and explore?
For me, the wilderness has held a strong appeal to me. So the reason why I go in the mountains is to get away from the crowds and to get out and to use skills and to challenge myself. And so I really think that you have to go a bit further these days to have those experiences. And I think they're more memorable too, in a way, because you're all a team working on it together. And you're using all your skills to try to figure it out. And so every day is an adventure. You know, we're not, you know, landing, hopping in a helicopter, being inserted into a hermetically sealed base camp and then putting a mask on and going to a summit. Like every day we're figuring out, because there's no infrastructure to get to these mountains. Or a lot of times we don't even know how to get there, like how to get the gear up to base camp or how, if there's a trail. So there's that aspect of it.
For people who are looking to follow in your footsteps, any advice that you could give them?
If you're very young, I recommend getting started in Scouts. Scouts is how I got started. I think it's still cool. I don't know. It was cool when I was a kid. So scouting was big then. And then from there in high school, if you can find outdoors clubs, you know, through the American Alpine Club, through local and regional chapters of the American Alpine Club is a great tool. And then also if you choose to go to college, then there's outdoor clubs, Alpine clubs through colleges and universities. So that's a great way to, there's Outward Bound and some of the larger organizations here in America that do like leadership for youth. Those are great opportunities for youth to get started in it. And there's even mentorship as well through the American Alpine Club. And so the resources are out there to get started. And that's how I got started. So yeah, here in the U.S.
What does the future hold for you?
This year, I'm focused on doing some introduction to skiing for some youth in Western Nepal, just because they have world-class ski terrain there and snow. So I'm focused on that for this year. I'm also doing some avalanche education for snow professionals in Kashmir in the Western Himalaya. Personally, I have some 8,000-meter projects I'll do on my own. For Himalaya Alpine Guides, for my guide service, will be in Pakistan and India and Nepal and in China this year, climbing and skiing and trekking. So there's a fair amount on the docket for the year, and it's looking really good in terms of coming out of COVID. So things are stabilizing. So I'm excited for the year. So,
and you have a book in progress. How's that come along?
Slow. Yeah, it's really, I really kind of battle with myself about whether I think there's just so many, like you walk through the streets of Kathmandu, like Tomel is like the tourist area of Kathmandu, Nepal. And you look at a bookshop and there's thousands of books about mountaineering. Does there need to be another one? I'm not certain about that. Like, I think if you write a book, there needs to be value for humanity for it. But maybe I'm a bit hard on myself. I think that, like, if you're telling stories that people are, you know, who are interested in the region, that the goal of my book is really, I'm working on just talking about the philosophy of expedition climbing and how I got into it and kind of what we were just talking about, like how you get started in Himalaya mountaineering and ski mountaineering. And that's kind of the focus of the book. So it's not really about things I've achieved. It's more about what I've learned about how to approach it and what to do while you're doing it. So that's the goal of the book.
Yeah. Well, I'd encourage you to finish that book because I believe that the experiences you have and these need to be shared with people. You've seen things and been places that even experienced Himalayan folks have not been, because you've been there with an eye of just not a climber, but of somebody who is curious about the culture, curious about the people. So you've seen things, experienced things that others just walked by or didn't bother to go over the next valley that's not so touristy.
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah, it's important to share. So yeah, sooner or later, a book will come out.
Yeah. Now, for folks who want to follow you, learn more about you, how can they do that?
Social media, I'm on there, Luke Smithwick. That's on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. And then also have a website, lukesmithwick.com. So there's updates there. And then for the guide service, it's himalaya-alpine.com.
Any final thoughts?
I hope people will check out the Himalaya. It's a fascinating place, and there's just a world of experiences there. So yeah, check it out. Amazing place.
Well, Luke, this has been a great conversation. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Mike. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, and safe travels. We'll see you down the road.
Cheers.
Thank you for joining us. We'll see you down the road when we get together again, share a glass of whiskey, and hear more stories of adventure as told by those who live them. Until then, check us out at michaeljreinhart.com, where you'll find more of my work as an adventure photojournalist. Photos, videos, and articles of interesting people, mysterious places, and exotic cultures for the wild places of the world.